Good evening, everybody. So let's take a moment to cultivate our motivation. Realizing once again that to rejoice in the fact that we have garnered this precious human life, so rare to find, so easily lost. And although we have all the freedoms and fortunes that come with a precious human life, we are still in samsara. We still have death knocking at our door, although we don't know when that knock will come. And when it does come, the only thing that we will have to take with us is our virtuous and non-virtuous karmic actions. So where do we want our minds to be? What do we want to experience? How do we want to savor and utilize this precious, precious opportunity to practice the Dharma? So let's set our intention on a number of different levels. First, to create the causes and conditions to have continuous, precious human rebirths so that we can gather momentum, that we can continually transform our minds and develop all the good qualities that we wish to their perfection, to attain some of the realizations of the path. And eventually, through these lifetimes of precious human rebirth, let's dedicate ourselves to liberation, not only for ourselves, but for the enlightenment of each and every living being who share this world, share this universe with us. They all have been our parents countless lives. They experience suffering like our own, much worse than our own. And so let's keep them in our thoughts, let's keep them in our minds as we listen to the Dharma tonight, knowing that whatever we cultivate in our minds, whatever intention we set forth, is not only for our own highest benefit, enlightenment, but also for the enlightenment of each and every one of them. Good evening, everyone, near and far. We are continuing on Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun. And I want to just shortly review some of the things that Venerable Chöni shared with us last week. And also some of the questions that came afterwards, the week following the review that Venerable Chöni covered. There were some questions that were sent to Venerable that I want to share because they were very insightful. So last week, Venerable Chöni reviewed some of the last on the section on karma, particularly around the results that we will experience, provided that the four factors to complete a karma are present, which are the four factors for karma to be complete: the object, the intention, action, and the completion. Okay. So for us to experience these four different results of karma, those four factors have to be present. There has to be an object identified. There has to be an intention behind it. There has to be the action itself and then the completion of the action. And so with those four factors present, we have four possible results. The first one is the ripening result, which means that depending on what type of mind state our mind is in at the time of death, whether we're holding virtuous thought or non-virtuous thought, that will propel us into our next rebirth. So hopefully with virtuous thoughts, we will attain a higher rebirth. Or if we are grasping and clinging and full of all sorts of non-virtuous thoughts, it will propel us to a lower realm. The second result that we will experience is that it's called the causally concordant result, which is the most devastating of the four results, is that we'll experience the habituation of both the non-virtuous and the virtuous actions that we've done in this life. So whatever we habituate ourselves to, whether it be lying, killing, stealing, divisive speech, or it's developing compassion, kindness, being very truthful in our speech, the more familiar, the more habituated we are to those particular forms of karma, in our next life, they will follow us as habituations. The third one is the experientially concordant result, which is we will experience results similar to the cause. So if we're going to do any type of non-virtuous karma, whether it be stealing, sexual misconduct, divisive speech, we will experience that from others. They will be dishonest with us. They will be unfaithful. They will harm us with words, body, speech, mind. And then the fourth one is the environmental result, which is, depending on the karma, is that we are reborn in certain types of environments. And each one of the 10 non-virtuous actions and each of the 10 virtuous actions create the causes for particular types of environment. And Venerable Choni went over these quite in detail, and it's fascinating. And the environments very much seem similar to the non-virtue that creates the result. She also spoke a little bit on the different factors, the five factors that determine the heaviness of the karma. And in particular, the one that I found very interesting was that the object that is that we sort of focus our intention and focus the karma on, depending on what that object is, very much determines the heaviness of the karma, both virtuous and non-virtuous. So the five factors are the intention, like how strongly do we want to do the action. The second one is the nature of the action. And this is whether we, you know, we create the karma by accident, whether it's done by ourselves, whether we ask somebody else to do it, whether we do it in a group. That determines also the heaviness of karma. The third one is, in particular to non-virtue, is we're going ahead and doing the action, not even thinking about trying to slow it down, subdue it, reroute ourselves. We're not even thinking of the antidote. We're just full speed ahead going to create the karma. And then the fourth one is distorted views. Once again, this is around non-virtuous karma. And an example of that would be the suicide bombers who thinking killing many people is going to bring them to heaven. That's a good example of a very distorted view. And then the last of the factors that determines the heaviness of the karma is the object. And the most powerful objects, and this is for both non-virtuous and virtuous, is your parents. Our parents are very strong objects of karma. Our spiritual teachers and mentors are very strong objects of karma. And also the poor, the needy, the ill, the oppressed. So depending on, and then other sentient beings are also objects of karma, but these three in particular will bring very, very powerful results, both on the virtuous side and the non-virtuous side. And so the following week after Venerable taught this, there were two questions that came around, and these are the kind of questions that I ask, so that's why I'm going to bring them up tonight. So one of the questions that came around is somebody asked about idle talk, because apparently idle talk brings a lower rebirth. And this person was saying, you know, I know that it's a great waste of time, but, you know, a horrible rebirth for, like, idle talk and chatter. Because we normally think of really obviously horrible stuff are going to bring lower rebirths, not things like talking about, you know, your vacation and your job and things like that. But how Venerable sort of responded to this question was, is that rarely are we just nonchalantly talking about nothing important. First of all, usually the first subject of our conversation when we're chatting or gossiping is ourselves. So we're talking about the things that we've done in our lives, and we tend to exaggerate because we're weaving a good story. That's all about what idle talk's about, is we're sharing what we did, where we went, yada, yada. And then the second thing is that the second thing that we normally talk about is others. So this is going to be either bringing up a lot of attachment in our mind, because we just met somebody that we absolutely adore. They're the most perfect person, the person that we've been waiting all of our lives. So there's all this attachment coming up. Or there's somebody at work that's just really screwing off and just making your work look bad, and there's nothing but bad words to say about this person. There's a lot of harsh speech. There's a lot of divisive speech. And so it's not so much what we're saying, it's that there's this tendency to just get out of control with our speech. So before we know it, we're creating all this negative karma, and all we're doing is sitting there having a cup of tea when in fact that's not what's happening. So, but one of the things that was very helpful is that she also kind of clarified this even farther and said that the Buddha talked a lot about idle speech. And he said, it's not so much about what you talk about, it's within the context of what you speak about. So she gave an example and said that, let's say, if you're talking about the arising and passing of things that are impermanent. So if you're talking about the real estate market or things that you've acquired, and you suddenly, you're talking about more about these things don't bring any lasting happiness. Or you've ended a relationship, you're realizing that things are impermanent, things change moment by moment. She said that if you're talking about real estate, the economy, your savings account, and things like that, is talking about it more through the perspective of these things don't last, these things don't bring lasting happiness, therefore they're not really worth clinging to. So she really wanted to be clear is that you can talk about certain worldly things, but if you put them within a Dharma perspective, where you're not only understanding more about what's Dharma talk, but you're also sharing some of your wisdom in a Dharma way. You can talk about a lot of things. You can talk about sports. You can talk about entertainment, but put it within the context of Dharma. The second topic that came up is how literal or how not literal. You know, are we going too literal in our interpretation of karma, or are we not going literally enough? And she gave two examples. She said, let's say, you call somebody a duck, you're going to be born as a duck 500 times. Or if you say, owe money, pay me home once, you're not going to ever have a lower rebirth. If you put these up against logic and reason, there's absolutely no basis to be able to believe in these things. And this is where she feels that the teachings are inspiring us to practice, and they're more of what she calls moral injunctions. They're made as a way to inspire somebody to practice. However, if you cheat on your spouse, you're going to have disharmony in your relationship. She says, take that as literally as it sounds, because that's what's going to happen. So we kind of, because becoming a duck 500 times, you've got to have a whole lot of causes and conditions to have something like that ripen. To have a higher rebirth, mantra recitation certainly is helpful, but you're going to have to cultivate a lot more positive potential to have a higher rebirth than just saying, oh, money, pay me home once. However, you've got the four factors completed in karma, you're going to experience the result, particularly if they're accompanied by attachment, anger, ignorance, jealousy. You can expect to experience a pretty specific result from that action. So she wanted to clarify this, how far we go to either side, either too literally or not literally enough. And then the other part that Venerable Cheney covered was the last of the preliminary of the four preliminaries, which was the disadvantages of cyclic existence. And Venerable spent quite a bit of time on this, and which, by the way, are the six disadvantages of cyclic existence: uncertainty, dissatisfaction, dying over and over, born over and over, changing status, going up and down, and suffer and die alone. And so she said to notice these in our experience, because one of the things that I think is very important, that now we finish the four preliminaries and we're going to be getting into bodhicitta, is I think she wants to make sure that we don't forget the four preliminaries, that she's really encouraging us to contemplate them, that she wants us to use them as antidotes when afflictions arise in our minds. And she she says that understanding and contemplating the six disadvantages of cyclic existence are really going to be able to generate in our mind, little by little, the sense of the determination to be free. And if we're going to generate bodhicitta, we've got to have enough compassion for ourselves to get out of cyclic existence first and foremost of all, because we're not going to be able to benefit sentient beings as perfectly as we want if we're still circling around in cyclic existence. So she said that cultivating those six disadvantages really cultivates a deep sense of compassion, wanting ourselves to be free from the cycle. And then she said what makes it even more profound is to take it another step and to think of the people in your life that you love, your friends, your family, your colleagues, and look at their lives and take each one of those disadvantages and to see how things are not stable in their lives, how they have dissatisfaction in their lives. Are they experiencing people dying in their lives, being born? Are they changing status? She says, then what happens is that then we get to cultivate compassion for them and then wish for them to be free. So to use the disadvantages not only for our own benefit, but also to see people in our lives and use it to generate compassion for them. But not to forget the four preliminaries. So the next is that we are now actually moving on to cultivating the conventional awakening mind. So first, Venerable talks about the two different kinds of bodhicitta. We've got conventional bodhicitta, or also called the altruistic intention. So these are the same thing. This is the wish to become a Buddha in order to perfectly benefit sentient beings. Now, one of the things that she clarifies is that she says ultimate bodhicitta is not bodhicitta. It's wisdom realizing emptiness. She says we really have to get used to this, because apparently, as she says, the way that we do it in the Tibetan Buddhist system is that we use a lot of categories, points, subpoints, headings, subheadings, and things like that. And she says just because something is listed under a category like bodhicitta doesn't mean that it's bodhicitta. It could be a description of that. It could be a cause of that. It could be a characteristic of that. It could be something that's just similar to that. So ultimate bodhicitta is wisdom realizing emptiness. It is not the bodhicitta that we are aspiring to develop in order to benefit all sentient beings and to attain enlightenment. And the ultimate bodhicitta will be dealt with in mind trainings like Rays of the Sun later on. So the first topic under conventional bodhicitta is appreciating the value of the awakening mind. So bodhicitta is the entrance to the Mahayana path, or the great vehicle. And a vehicle in this context is a path. A path is a consciousness. And specifically, it's a consciousness that has some understanding of emptiness, conceptually, non-conceptually. And it's called a vehicle because if you have a certain kind of consciousness, this vehicle will deliver you to the destination that you are pointed in. So the great vehicle, which is a great mental state like bodhicitta, is going to bring you to the destination of enlightenment. So first we need to appreciate enlightenment, and we need to appreciate bodhicitta. So this is the section which is sort of the advertising. Because in the advertising world, what we do first, at least with the eight worldly concerns, is that it's usually an object of desire. And because advertising wants us to buy it, crave it, want it, it exaggerates its qualities, sometimes to the point where it's outright, you know, lying. But when it comes to the advertisement as far as bodhicitta goes, that this publicity is telling us the truth. And that is leading us to a very beneficial goal. So there's no exaggeration, that the object is a virtuous object. And there's definitely something about training the mind to be able to see the benefits of something. And in the Tibetan Buddhist, in the Lam Rim in particular, there's a lot of teachings that go through the disadvantages of something and the advantages of something. So the more that you understand the benefits of the awakening mind or any virtuous thought, is that then you get inspired, then you get enthusiastic, you get curious, you want to see what that experience is like. So you see this a lot in the teachings of the advantages. And why is it necessary? Why is the awakening mind necessary? Because we want to benefit all sentient beings. So then we have a few quotes here from Nam Kapel. You may wonder, what is the entrance to such activity? In stating that there are two aspects to the great vehicle, the practices of the transcending perfections and those of the secret mantra, Buddha the Conqueror has made it clear that there is no great vehicle practice other than these two. So we've got, in simple English, we have the Mahayana, the great vehicle, and there are two aspects to this. The first one is the practice of the far-reaching practices, which are generosity, patience. Okay, let's do that again. Generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, this is one of the aspects of the great vehicles, the practice of the paramitas or the far-reaching practices. And the other one is the practice of the secret mantra or Vajrayana. Now, this is where Venerable, she jokes about getting on her soapbox, but this is definitely one of her soapbox moments, is that she wants to be very clear that Vajrayana is a branch of the Mahayana practice. It is not separate from the Mahayana practice. And that she says, in the West, we have got this new division of the three different vehicles. We say that they're Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana. And what she says is no, no, no. First of all, Vipassana is in all the Buddhist traditions. It's a form of meditation that comes in quite necessary along the path, but it's not separate from the Buddhist path. The second one, Zen, if you look at the Mahayana path, there are many different kinds of Mahayana paths. They're not all Chan, they're not all Zen. There's Tendai, there's Pure Land. There's a lot of different Mahayana practices. Zen is not a particular vehicle separate from the Mahayana path. And the third of these, the Vajrayana, is underneath the umbrella of the Mahayana. It is not separate. To be a Vajrayana practitioner, you need a strong basis in the fundamental vehicle where you need to understand and have a very strong commitment to renunciation. Four noble truths you have to understand. Karma, the disadvantages of cyclic existence. And then moving on into the six far-reaching practices, you have to have such a strong basis to even think about practicing the Vajrayana. So you can't just take it out of the Buddhist traditions and practice it separate from that. It needs a very strong foundation. So those are the three vehicles, the fundamental vehicle, the Mahayana vehicle, and then the Vajrayana. So when practicing the far-reaching practices or the Vajrayana, the entrance to each of these is bodhicitta. You've got to have this generated or the aspiration to generate it to be able to enter the Mahayana practice. The moment it arises, bodhicitta, in your mental continuum, even if you have not generated any other quality, you become a follower of the great vehicle. This is very encouraging. however, if you have spontaneous bodhicitta, you can still lose it, because where you accumulate, when you experience spontaneous bodhicitta, you enter the bodhisattva path of accumulation. And the bodhisattva path of accumulation has three different levels, the small, the medium, and the great. When you first enter that path and have the experience of spontaneous bodhicitta, you are still in samsara, it's still fragile, it's not stable. Find yourself in a situation where you're in the middle of a situation that's very volatile, that somebody is screaming, yelling, beating, denigrating you, and you're just getting furious with them and say, forget it, you know, just forget even wanting to benefit this person. That spontaneous bodhicitta, you're going to lose it. So it's very delicate and very fragile in the beginning of the path of accumulation. So we can't get too complacent if and when that day comes where we have that experience of bodhicitta. We can lose it for quite some time as we're going along the path of accumulation. So we have to prevent that from happening. So then we continue with more of Nag Kapel. So whether you are considered a practitioner of the Great Vehicle or not depends simply on whether you possess bodhicitta. In fact, the Great Vehicle is indicated by nothing but the presence or absence of this state of mind. This is what makes you a Mahayanist or not. What makes you enter the bodhisattva path or not is the presence or absence of bodhicitta. As Shantideva writes in his book, A Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the instant the awakening mind is activated, those bound up in the prison of cyclic existence come to be known as children of the Buddhas, gone to bliss. And today I have been born into the family of the Buddhas and have become a child of the awakened ones. So this is where Venerable wants to clarify exactly who are, you know, the child of the awakened one and what's this whole family thing going on. Because we have some of our chants where we have, oh, good, 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 oh, child of the lineage, it is like that. Oh, spiritual child of the lineage, oh, spiritual child of the essence. So this is another term for bodhisattva. When you have entered the bodhisattva path, you're not joining some aristocratic special club. You have put your sort of your money where your mouth is. You're on the bodhisattva path, and you have the Buddha is your relationship to the Buddha has changed very profoundly because you have made the commitment to become a Buddha, to follow in your father's footsteps, your mother's footsteps, to become a Buddha to benefit sentient beings. So it's the lineage of the Buddhas that you are becoming a child of. But we are still bound up in samsara. So we're still fragile. We're still delicate. We still have to accumulate vast amounts of merit and positive potential. But we have stepped onto the path and we've joined this family. Now, there are two kinds of bodhisattvas. This I found, I find this fascinating. It's something I'm trying to really wrap my mind around. So there's the bodhisattva that newly steps onto the path of accumulation. They don't have any other realizations, perhaps, but spontaneous bodhicitta. They are freshly new bodhisattvas. Then there are those that have practiced the fundamental path, who have become arhats. And through their own path as hearers, they've gone through the path of accumulation, of preparation, of meditation, of seeing, meditation, no more learning to become an arhat. They've gone into meditative equipoise. They've attained liberation. They are in that for eons. And the Buddha calls them out to come back and to engage onto the bodhisattva path. They have to go all the way back to the path of accumulation on the bodhisattva path. So you've got a bodhisattva who's been practicing the Mahayana vehicle, freshly onto the path of accumulation, and you've got an arhat who has now joined the path of accumulation. And what happens here is that, so what, and also the bodhisattva that's coming from the path of the hearer has the realization of emptiness. The bodhisattva that's on the path of accumulation may not have any realization of emptiness. The bodhisattva that's entered the path from Mahayana vehicle will reach Buddhahood first before the bodhisattva who's come from arhatship. And Venerable explains this. Is that because the person who has who became an arhat has to overcome the tendency for liberation. That during a course of lifetimes, and now in meditative equipoise, have been in that experience that the imprint is so strong for self-liberation that they now almost have to undo that. And that also that they can just go into meditative equipoise on emptiness whenever they wish, to just go into this bliss of nirvana. So to go on to the path of accumulation with these very strong tendencies, they become obstacles to them. Where the new bodhisattva, who's, you know, no realizations of emptiness, is working hard to accumulate merit, is trying to understand the conceptual understanding of emptiness and inferences, and so they're going in the same time, but one is going to reach Buddhahood beforehand. And so it's very important to accumulate the merit and certainly to accumulate the wisdom. So then somebody asked Venerable, what happens if the bodhisattva from the Mahayana path realizes emptiness before they realize bodhicitta? She said, usually the realization of emptiness before bodhicitta is a conceptual understanding. It's not a direct perception. However, that understanding greatly aids in their generating bodhicitta. And here she talks about in Chandrakirti's homage to great compassion, that there are three kinds of compassion, which we talked about a few weeks ago. The third one, which is the compassion of the unapprehendable, that having even the conceptual understanding of emptiness helps them cultivate a deep, profound compassion because they understand that the sentient beings are empty of any inherent existence. Therefore, there's a capacity to free them, to release them from suffering. And that this understanding of emptiness makes their compassion very profound, but they still have to cultivate bodhicitta, they still have to cultivate wisdom, they've got to do this through three great eons, but having the conceptual understanding helps a lot in generating bodhicitta, particularly the compassion part, which is one of the causes for bodhicitta. The beauty about needing wisdom along the path is that it helps you to eliminate all the miseries and fears. So as you're generating bodhicitta and you're trying to realize emptiness, there's looking at the suffering of sentient beings, but because you're starting to see the emptiness of the suffering, emptiness of true existence of the sentient beings, the fear and the misery doesn't sort of overwhelm you. You're able to be fearless. Your mind is very strong. It's very courageous because you understand that the suffering is, you can eliminate the suffering. You can benefit the sentient beings, that the compassion becomes very profound. The wisdom, it makes your mind really very fearless and very courageous. So there's a beautiful imagery that Venerable shared that I want to repeat because it's just lovely, the visuals. And this is stated in the array of the Tree Trunk Sutra. O child of my family, the awakening mind is like the seed of all the teachings of the Buddhas. It is like the field in which the positive actions of all wandering beings prosper. It is like the earth on which the whole world depends. It is like the son of the Lord of Wealth who completely eliminates all kinds of poverty. It is like the father completely protecting all bodhisattvas. It is like the king of wish-granting jewels which perfectly fulfills every purpose. It is like the miraculous vase which acts to accomplish every wish. It is like a spear vanquishing the foe of disturbing emotions. It is like the armor guarding you from improper thoughts. It is like a sword beheading the disturbing emotions. It is the axe felling the tree of disturbing emotions. It is like a weapon staving off all kinds of attack. It is like the hook which draws you out of the waters of cyclic existence. It is like the whirlwind that scatters all mental obstructions and their sources. It is like the shrine before which all the gods, humans, and demigods of the world can present their offerings. O child of my family, the awakening mind is endowed like this, with these and immeasurable other excellent qualities. So this, if that isn't inspiring. So we get really discouraged and we're like, oh, these sentient beings, including myself, we're such a piece of work. This is the kind of imagery that we want to bring into our minds. And we had some lovely ones too. Venerable asked us to think about some of the benefits of bodhicitta, and some of us said that it brings a sense of contentment, a sense of ease, a deep acceptance and understanding of others. It helps to overcome self-centeredness, reduces our own suffering. Bodhicitta gives our lives purpose. It gives us hope, overcomes cynicism and despair, makes the mind vastly expansive, makes it fearless, improves our ethical discipline and patience. So if we're not into the sword and the staff and the flourishing of the wish-fulfilling gem, we can at least celebrate the fact that we're taking care of our self-centeredness and it's giving our life great purpose. So then we go on to the actual outline, where there are two stages for training the mind. And there are two sections. The stages for training the mind have two sections. The first point is called the instructions for actually training in the conventional bodhicitta. That's the one we will address first. And the second one is the five precepts that are factors of the training, which will be dealt with later. So under the instructions for actually training in the conventional bodhicitta, there are two subdivisions. Surprise, surprise. The process of cultivating the awakening mind that is concerned with the welfare of others, and the process of cultivating the awakening mind concerned with attaining the fully awakened state of being. So here we have some clarification. This I found amazing. And you may want to, as I go through this, Venerable lined it out, and it might be worth writing down. And I'll tell you when that happens. Bodhicitta is a primary mind with two mental factors. One of the mental factors is the cause for bodhicitta. It is not bodhicitta itself. The mind that is concerned with the welfare of others is the cause for bodhicitta. It is not bodhicitta. The second of the mental factors, together with bodhicitta, is concerned with attaining the fully awakened state. So we have the mind that cares about the welfare of others, which is the cause of bodhicitta, and then we generate bodhicitta, which wants to attain enlightenment. So this is the part that I think is, I'd love for Venerable just to give a teaching on this. The object of bodhicitta is enlightenment. It's not sentient beings. But the cause of bodhicitta, the thing that comes before it, is the aspiration to benefit sentient beings. The object of that aspiration is sentient beings who are suffering. The cause of that aspiration to benefit sentient beings is great compassion. And the object of that great compassion are the sentient beings who are undergoing suffering. Dependent arising, for sure. So the process of cultivating the awakening mind that is concerned with the welfare of others, which is what the first of those two points, has two subdivisions. The first one is exchanging yourself with others through acknowledging the faults of self-centeredness and the advantages of having concern for others. And then the second point under that is actually cultivating the awakening mind that is concerned with the interest of others. So this is the point where she asks, well, what's missing in this? We've gone into cultivating the awakening mind through the practice of exchanging yourself and others. So we don't have the 7-point instruction of cause and effect. In this book in particular, Nam Kapel goes right into equalizing, exchanging self and others as the main practice, as does Shantideva in his book, Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So here is where Venerable puts the pause button, because she's not going to let us go any further without going through the 7-point instruction of cause and effect. So that's where we're going to go. So the 7-point instruction of cause and effect has a preliminary practice, and the preliminary practice is equanimity. Now, equanimity has a lot of different meanings in Tibetan Buddhism, and the one that, depending on the context, and the way it's used here is that equanimity is a balanced mind that is free of attachment to friends, aversion to enemies, and indifference to strangers. It has to do with our feelings towards sentient beings. It's not about the state of our mind in single point concentration, or it's not anything about us. It's about others. And she says that equanimity is one of the most powerful practices that we can utilize in our daily life, because there isn't any moment, hardly in our daily life, where we have any equanimity whatsoever. And that the lack of equanimity is the source of what she calls this yo-yo mind, this up and down, up and down, up and down. And that the judgmental mind is the mind that lacks equanimity. So Venerable goes into quite a bit of detail on talking about the judgmental mind, and that it evaluates everything we encounter, everyone that we encounter, in terms of ourselves. It's very self-referenced. So the self is the most important thing in the world, and that anybody who appears in our world is evaluated in terms of what they can do for us. And so the judgmental mind starts, the first thing is, there's all sorts of things that the judgmental mind does this monologue about. Somebody praises me, very good. Somebody criticizes me, very bad. Somebody praises me, very good. Somebody points out my good qualities, very good. Somebody tells me I vacuum very nicely, very good. Somebody says I don't know how to wash the dishes very well, very bad. So we go through the whole day judging people's words towards just any inconsequential thing as being a judgment on them, their value. Their value is dependent upon how they relate to me. And if they say good things about me, they're good people. If they say bad and critical things about me, they're bad people. And to think that we do this moment by moment, we place value on another living being based on how they relate to us. There's no objectivity whatsoever. And they use this really, this example that Venerable has used over the years and many of our teachers have used over the years, and I'm beginning to appreciate how crazy we are. And so it's, she calls it the berserky mind, and this is a perfect example. She says you have two people. So today one person gives you, we should up the ante, but anyway, we'll start at $1,000. The other person insults you. Okay, so we know who the friend is and we know who the enemy is. The next day, the person who gave you the $1,000 insults you, and the person who insulted you gives you $1,000. Now who's the enemy? Now who's the friend? The next day, the person who originally gave you a gift that insulted you yesterday is now giving you another present. And the person who gave you, who insulted you first, gave you $1,000 yesterday, is now insulting you again, is now your enemy. So, but when you look at it from a bigger perspective, you've got insults and you've got money changing hands, and we actually think that we make these rational decisions on who's a friend and who's an enemy depending on this thing that keeps switching. It's sort of like that shell game, you know, where you put a pea underneath it and you try to figure out where the pea is. So this is what Venerable calls the berserky mind, because things are going to change moment by moment, but at that moment where we call them an enemy because they insulted us, we believe that person is an enemy forever. The next day when they give us $1,000, that person is a friend forever. And this changes every 15 minutes in our life. And the thing that she says, it's crazy in a kind of a funny, insane sort of way, and she says it's also very tragic because we have this precious human life that's fleeting, that we have created the causes over thousands of lifetimes to have. And what do? We make all this. This is what we do. We do all this mental craziness rather than using our precious human life to create virtue and to abandon negativity. And she says it's very tragic, very sad on what we do with this precious human life. And this judgmental mind is the greatest user of our precious life, wasting it, wasting it, wasting it, and also creating a lot of negative karma. So the question comes up then, does it mean that I'm detached from everybody? Does it mean, well, if I can't have a friend I'm attached to and an enemy that I don't like and a stranger that I'm indifferent to, does that mean that I don't have any feelings, that I just kind of sit there, that I don't love anybody, I don't hate anybody, I just have this equanimity, kind of blah sort of thing? And she says, equanimity doesn't mean that you put everybody at arm's length, that you put up this fence and you say, you know, don't get close, I'm very attached, I'm very equanimous, but just don't bother me. She says that equanimity is this very open-hearted concern for all beings equally. It's just that you don't have them in these different categories, that you treat and care, you wish well, all sentient beings equally. So then the next question is, well, if I have equanimity, does it mean that I treat everybody the same? Because now I've got people I'm attached to, now I have people that I don't like. So if I don't have attachment and anger, then does it mean that I treat everybody the same? And Venerable says, no, that's not what equanimity is either. Because we have these different social roles. If you had, you don't give a two-year-old matches, but you would give, you know, an adult matches. You wouldn't give you'd give your keys to your house to your friend, but you wouldn't give your keys to a stranger. So she said that she read a book once that said we should give people the amount of trust that they can bear. So different people can bear different amounts of trust, depending on their maturity, their capacity, what our relationship is to them, what our sort of social status or, you know, relationship is to them, what our custom, what our culture defines. But at the same time, your mind is still open. Your mind is still seeing people equally, having this warm-hearted feeling, although you treat them differently. These are not paradoxes. We can do this. We can deal with people differently, and we can still feel equally the same love and concern. So once we get, you know, whatever level of understanding that we have about equanimity, if we can get some sense of how important it is, because if we're going to see the first point of the seven-point instruction of cause and effect is to see all beings that have been our parents, we've got to have some level of understanding of friend, enemy, and stranger just being labels. So she's changed this because in the teachings they say that all beings have been our mothers. But she very strongly feels that gender equity is very important, so all beings have been our mothers, all beings have been our dads. And that she said to have some understanding of this, it's very profound, all beings have been our parents, is that we have to have some sort of feeling or willingness to think about rebirth. Because one of the things that binds us is that we see the parents of this life as truly existent, that they have been and will always be our parents, rather than seeing them as these impermanent phenomena with bodies and minds, living in this short life as our parents due to our karma, and that when they die, they will be reborn someplace else and they will cease to be our parents. So if we want to see all beings as our parents, we've got to sort of open up the box that says, it's only these parents of this life that I have a connection to. And we can do that by loosening this grasp about them being these very solid, inherently existent living beings. The second one, which is then seeing their kindness. And Venerable spends a lot of time on this one. And part of it is that she says, in the West, we blame a lot of our neuroses, a lot of our psychological problems on our parents. And I was one of those people for over 40 years that did that. And so she really encourages us to go back to our parents and to really appreciate their kindness. They're the ones that gave us this body. And they are the ones that did their very best to bring us up. And they were imperfect human beings just like us. Everybody had their own craziness. Everybody had their own struggles. But from the viewpoint of our parents, that they were really doing the best that they could. And the fact that we are alive today is a testament to their kindness. And that's one of the pieces that's very profound. I mean, no matter what happened when we were children, the fact that we are alive says something about the kindness of our parents. Because when we were infants, we were totally, completely helpless. And whether it was parents or grandparents or foster parents or aunts and uncles who raised us, we would have died if it were not for their kindness. And when we look at other parents treating their infants and saying to them, thinking in our minds, that's the way I was treated when I was a baby, that opens up a whole possibility of seeing our parents in this really beautiful, heartwarming, love sort of way. Because when I think about myself as a baby, thinking that my parents had financial problems, they might have had mental problems, they were dealing with their relationship with each other and having three screaming small children running around trying to keep their relationship healthy and intimate and honest and open. You know, all of the cultural, the economic problems that might have been going on, the fact that they could keep their wits about them to keep us alive and to teach us how to talk and walk and send us to school and buy us clothes and feed us is an absolutely remarkable achievement. And so by going back over our lives and seeing their kindness and having this wish to just spontaneously want to repay that kindness. And how do we do that? We do that by practicing the Dharma and realizing the path so that we can become Buddhas and truly benefit them. And that isn't just the parents of this life, but this is every sentient being who has been our parent since beginningless time. And so the third point is repaying this kindness. And as long as it takes for any of us to get this sense in our hearts on how precious and how kind our parents or our caregivers were is a huge, it sort of propels you through this whole practice in a very deep way. And I certainly, from my own side, I have experienced great opening in my life in regards to my parents by doing this practice. Then the fourth step is, after repaying their kindness, is heartwarming love, which is this love that wishes happiness and the causes of happiness for all living beings. And it also sees sentient beings in beauty. So when you look at another sentient being, you see them as lovable, you see them as worthy of care, of kindness, of concern, of good wishes. And so this is the feeling of love that arises when you go through these stages and get this kind of heartfelt experience. This love then naturally arises. The fifth one then from the heartwarming love is wishing then that all of these sentient beings who you not only want to wish happiness and the cause of happiness for, but you want them to be free of all the suffering and all the causes of suffering. And at this point, Venerable goes into some detail because she says that the first three, seeing all beings as your parents, seeing the kindness and wanting to repay it, is the basis for the generation of the aspiration to benefit. So this is where there's these very subtle differences between aspirations and wishes and thoughts and actually moving forward. So the first three are the basis for generating the aspiration to benefit sentient beings. The fourth and fifth, which are the love and compassion, are the actual wishes. So we've gone, the commitment's gotten deeper. It's not just one of these someday, somewhere. It's gone deeper down into, I really do want this to happen. And then the great resolve, which is the actual thought that says, I myself alone will bring happiness to all beings. May I create the causes for that. And I myself alone will free them from suffering and its causes. So there's this very subtle but very profound steps that go through the practice of bodhicitta from the very high aspiration to the wish to the actual commitment to it. And what we wish for them and what we want to do for them is to teach them the tools to liberate themselves. We want them to be free from suffering, the karma that causes the suffering, the ignorance that brings all of this about. We want to teach them how to avoid negative karma, how to create positive karma, and to be free from all the afflictions altogether, because the afflictions, the karma, the ignorance are what bring them into birth, aging, sickness, and death over and over again. So what we're wishing, what we're committing ourselves to is everlasting happiness and the absolute elimination of suffering once and for all. Now, at this point, we have to be careful of three things when in regards to the great resolve, these little traps that we can fall into, because there's a lot going on in our minds at this point. The first one is that love and compassion must be stable and impartial. If there is any attachment whatsoever, this great love and this great compassion is going to be on very unstable ground. The second one is we must be careful not to fall into personal distress or have a personal agenda. And this is, the personal distress is when we're starting to clearly see others suffering. And it's becoming so painful that we turn our attention away from their suffering and we start to focus on our own suffering experience of watching others suffer. So this is a strange way in which, once again, the subtle self-centeredness turns its attention away from sentient beings and brings the attention back on ourselves. And this can be quite a pitfall because people get all sorts of burnout. They walk away from some devoted experiences and commitments in their lives because they don't have the capacity to watch others suffer. So some of the ways that will help us is that we need to know that we can't stop it. You know, we aren't Buddhas yet. We can't teach them. We can't benefit them perfectly. And sometimes we're just powerless in the face of what they're experiencing. Plus, we can't change people's karma. The second one is that we realize that we can't fix them. At times we see so clearly how their suffering could end, but we can't help them because they can't see it. And Venerable says, this is just like the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who've been watching us for countless great eons. They know exactly what we need to do to eliminate our suffering, and they have no way to connect with us because our obscurations, our afflictions are so out of control that we don't know how to help ourselves, and we're not at a point where we can hear them, that we can receive the realizations to the level that we can then really start eliminating our own suffering. So they're kind of in the same situation with us as we are with other sentient beings. And we also need to be able to benefit them even in the face of harm. So for situations where we may be harmed, to be able to be so courageous and so fearless. And this is where that third objectless compassion, to get to the point of understanding, realizing emptiness, where the whole personal distress would be absolutely eliminated because we would see the suffering as empty of any inherent existence. And then the third one that we can fall into is that to expect them to return the favor and repay our kindness. So there are strings attached. There's conditions to our love. There's conditions to our compassion. I want you to be happy, but I want you to be happy in this particular way. You know, I want you to be free from suffering, but I want you to do it this way. And we've got to be willing to let go any expectations of ever getting anybody to listen to us, to take our wisdom, to follow through, to even care what we have to say. And in fact, we are the ones who are indebted for their kindness because they're giving us the opportunity to practice. That is their greatest gift, to practice bodhicitta, to cultivate all of our good qualities, to practice patience, loving kindness, compassion. They are, as we've been told, that each one of us, we depend on each sentient being for our own enlightenment. And that is the absolute greatest gift that they offer to us. And if we can somehow bypass or work our way through these three obstacles in regard to the great resolve, these are the six causes, and then number seven is the result, which is bodhicitta. To become a Buddha, to accomplish everything that we want to accomplish. And so this practice is, I find it profound, and I find it crucial in working with self-centered thought and developing many of the six far-reaching practices. This practice is quite precious. So I took out a lot because there was so much in this teaching, but these were the high points of the month of February where Venerable really went into detail on the seven-point instruction of cause and effect. So if you want to download the teachings, it's going to be the month of February that she did the teaching specifically that I reviewed tonight. So let's dedicate.
To this merit may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. Of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions. And especially at Travasti Abbey in the West Flourish.